Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Min Shan. Devon Lipscomb is a formerly incarcerated student studying rehabilitation and human services at Penn State. He also works as a special projects coordinator for the Restorative Justice Initiative in the College of Education, where he creates dialogue around the intersection of race, institutional barriers, and trauma associated with incarceration. He's the recipient of this year's Outstanding Adult Student Award and Stand Up Award from the Rock Ethics Institute at Penn State. Devine Lipscomb, welcome to Take Note.
Thank you for having me.
You have talked about how being a formerly incarcerated student is an important part of your identity. Can you start by talking about the circumstances of your incarceration and how it has changed you?
So I experienced incarceration at two points in my life, once at the age of 14, and then again at the age of 16. And I was also institutionalized in a rehabilitation program at the age of 15. It impacted me because, one, at such a young age and such an important part of my developmental stages were spent locked away in cages for making decisions that technically my brain was not developed enough to even comprehend the consequences for. And so most of my developmental years were spent under the tutelage or under the supervision of the state, which has direct impacts such as trauma, high levels of anxiety, trust issues. There's a slew of barriers, especially as I'm learning through my courses, that are a direct result of incarceration.
And you came to Penn State in 2018 to study rehabilitation and human services as an undergraduate student. And you told me it wasn't easy, and you made several attempts to enroll, actually. What were the barriers in that?
So the barriers in enrollment were because of my crime, and not just the crime that I committed. So my first time applying to Penn State, I was accepted. But I didn't meet certain criteria, like math criteria, and so I was not accepted into the School of Business, which I have an associate's degree in business. And so because Penn State doesn't take anyone else's business credits, and I didn't meet a math criteria, I wasn't accepted. But I was accepted into the College of Liberal Arts. So at that time, I wasn't aware that Penn State, like, to do things within 2 weeks of enrolling into school, which is also their busiest time. And I was unable to get people on the phone to direct me and how to enroll in the College of Liberal Arts. The second time I tried to enroll, there wasn't a financial component during the first time I was accepted. So I was accepted again, but then they were like, here, you need to pay this $250 before we accept you. Have children. At that point, I had employment, but it wasn't gainful employment, and it didn't allow me to have $250 in savings or to have any form of disposable income, and so I couldn't enroll. The third time, I anticipated that I was going to have this barrier of $250, which actually it was a little more, and I knew what college I needed to enroll in. So I because I've experienced those other two instances, I was better prepared the final time I got accepted and enrolled into Penn State.
Were you discouraged?
Yes, no. One of the things that I've found about my form of resiliency is that if I want to actually succeed at something, tell me no, I can't do it. And it pushes me to want it even more. But I also know the importance of education and what education has done for me in my life. And so every time Penn State told me no or said yes, but put a barrier in my way, I would take, I think the first time I enrolled, I didn't try or attempt to re-enroll again for about a year. The second time it took me about 2 years to apply again. So there were gaps in between me coming back to the application process. But no, it never completely discouraged me from trying to come back.
And when you first arrived on campus, finally in 2018, you said that you felt somewhat at lost and you were without support. Can you talk about the experience then? What made you feel that way?
So, one, I'm an adult student. I'm an adult learner, and through my travels in life, I understand that people need support systems. Even children, well, not children, young adults, when they enter into college, they seek out their peers or people who have a certain affinity to them. That's human nature. Like, we look for people that we can relate to. And when I arrived on campus, I looked for people I can relate to, older individuals, some who were formerly incarcerated, or at least had one of my salient identities, outside of being African American and being male, right? But I needed someone who was pursuing the same path that I was, who had similar experiences to me, which is hard to find. I mean, I still haven't found it in 2020, someone who was formerly incarcerated, who understands the struggles of being in a classroom with 18, 19-year-olds, whose main objective is to party or to be, what do they call it when you're trying to pledge? Those aren't my aspirations, right? I'm looking for individuals who are in a master's program that are like, okay, how do we actually change the world, opposed to talking about changing the world, you know? Without those kind of supports, I started to feel alone. I started to feel like, am I going to survive this campus life?
Do you feel like you're still as lonely as you were when you first got here?
No, I'm not lonely at all. I found a great support system in the college. So we changed the name. I think it's the Office of Education and Equity, in the College of Ed. It was the Office of Multicultural Programs. Still getting used to the name, so bosses, please forgive me if I just butchered it. But yes, so I was asked to do a panel for Ephraim Arimon, who is the director for Restorative Justice Initiative. And after that, I was still in the College of Liberal Arts, and he invited me to come over to the Office of Education and Social Equity, I believe that's the name. And I went over and I met Dean Schmidt, and I met Brenda Martinez, all office. And then I met a few undergrads who were in the office, Deja, Jovan, like some key elements and individuals for that particular space, and immediately I felt welcome, and I felt like I was at home, because we were all like-minded in our goals and our mission, which is to provide educational pathways for individuals with minority background or underrepresented communities. My passion happens to be formerly incarcerated individuals, but they all lead down the same walkway.
And you are now a special projects coordinator for the Restorative Justice Initiative on campus. So, can you talk more in detail about the work that you do for the initiative and why are you passionate about it?
Yes, the joke still is, everything's a special project, right? And so I'm pretty much involved in almost any component of the organization. My role, particularly, is to be a support to all of the many efforts that are housed under the RGA umbrella, which consists of educational programming and our correctional facilities, a direct outreach on our campus, our student. Restorative Justice Initiative. I am the incoming president for that. And also, more importantly, I think, is to bring that voice, that representation to the organization. One thing that is key in anything that we do in this world, which I don't think some people have figured this out yet, is representation is important, right? If people cannot identify what you're doing, and they don't feel represented, your organization is almost like a dictatorship. It doesn't represent the people. And RJI is about restorative justice. It's about having those pathways for people to navigate back into society, or to at least comfortably find spaces that they can exist. And so that's my role. At least I believe that's my role. That's how I operate.
Did you feel like you have seen that kind of representation that you were talking about as you were growing up in your process of learning and your process of growth? Or was that lacking for you?
It wasn't there when I was growing up, but I had different goals growing up also. By the time I was 10, I remember I wanted to be a police officer. Or some kind
you did.
Of, I did. Yeah, I wanted to be a cop, and then I wanted to go from being an officer to being an FBI agent, and then I wanted to join the CIA. Those were my goals at 5, 6, 7, 8 in Brooklyn, right? So I was born and raised in Brooklyn. By the time I was 10 and entering junior high school, I actually met the police. I was stopped and frisked every day. I was harassed by the police every day. I was treated less than. And so my image of the police was no longer John McClane, Die Hard. It was no longer Riggs, Lethal Weapons. It wasn't all of these fantastic cops bringing justice to the world. It was, I didn't do anything wrong. Why are you bothering me, right? And so when I met the police, my images of the police changed, my reality of police changed. But then I met the gangsters as well, right? And they lived up to what was romanticized on television. They had the money, they had the cars, they had the respect, all things that people yearn for growing up in impoverished neighborhoods. And when you're shown something, that's what you tend to want. And so I wanted to be a gangster, and there was room for me to be a gangster. So that was the representation I saw. And so that's the path I followed.
What changed along the way?
As far as?
You have now a new set of goals. You have a new set of ambitions. I think, you know, the things that you're looking to do is different. You're talking about restorative justice. What changed along the way? How did you figure out now what's the most important thing for you?
So the first time I sat inside of a locked room, I knew that I needed or wanted to change some things. When I was introduced to rehab at 15 and the idea of what addiction was, I was also exposed to my ability to listen and to counsel, right? So I was told since the age of 15 that I was supposed to be a counselor. And I rejected that notion. I don't want to counsel people. I don't even like people. To this day, I still believe I don't like people. But if you ask my wife, she's going to disagree with me, right? But my goals have ultimately always been the same. So in my traumas, when there was abuses taking place in my household, I was the caregiver, right? And so I'm still essentially a caregiver. That's just my role in life. That's who I am. Without knowing what that is, though, I couldn't embrace it. And when I wasn't embracing it, I was causing harm, right? And so when I moved away from addiction, so I'm on a path of to long-term recovery. And so when I put my drug of choice down and I started to deal with my traumas, it became a little easier for me to identify who I am as a person and what my role is supposed to be in this world. And that's to create pathways, that's to be an empathetic ear, That is to help empower individuals. That is to create healing spaces for trauma. Because I am a caregiver. That's who I am. And that's who I've always been. I think we all know who we are. It's just a matter of, do we have access to blossom into that full potential?
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Devine Lipscomb, a formerly incarcerated student studying rehabilitation and human services at Penn State. He also works as a special projects coordinator for the Restorative Justice Initiative in the College of Education and is an advocate for better supporting those reentering society after incarceration. Sounds like it took a really long time for you to go down this personal path, and I'm sure everyone's path is very different. But what do you think that the general public doesn't understand about you, about reentry, about those who have similar struggles like yourself?
Oh, that's simple. What the general public does not understand is we all want the same thing. Right? We all aspire to the same things.
And what are those?
To live comfortably, to be happy. If you ask anybody what they want, they're going to say to be happy. And to be financially stable, right? We want to have money to take care of our family and to enjoy ourselves and live and have some type of ownership, right? Most people don't say, oh, I want to go rent a condo. They say, I want to own a condo, right? So we all seek to own something, to have something that is ours. Most people in the general public have access to that power, right? But then we start the touch that we need to touch on systemic problems, systemic issues like generational wealth, right? Generational wealth next to generational trauma. We talk about access to education opposed to policing in schools, right? My children go to SCASD, right? Their library in their high school is bigger than half of my junior high school. They have access to education. They have access to teachers who care. I'm not saying my teachers didn't care, but my teachers didn't have the resources. Those pathways, which is what our RJI focuses on, is those pathways to that educational platform are different. And if you don't give people access, you leave them no other outcomes, right? When you take those things away from people, you leave them marginalized, you leave them impoverished, and I can't get a better job if I don't have a job, right? Or if I don't create a business. So we talk about economic issues. All people strive for the same things. It's just who has access to it and who doesn't.
You see education as a crucial pathway for upward mobility and for successful, meaningful reentry. Why is that? And how has your own experience shaped that belief?
If you don't teach someone how to fish, they will never learn how to feed themselves. They will always ask you for a handout. Education is that pathway for me. One thing an old timer told me when I was 17 years old in a state correctional facility was, the one thing they can never take from you, Devine, is your education. Take this book, read. I've been reading ever since. I've been pursuing education ever since. As long as I keep my mind thriving, there's always going to, I can find an opportunity somewhere. I can learn how to do this, and I can if I master it, it might generate some income. That opens doors. But that kind of, that formal education, so for me, it's formal education. I love formal education. I love being in the space. I love the intellectual debates. I don't have to agree with people all the time. I don't need to agree with you all the time. Because if you agree with me and I agree with you, what did we actually learn? We just found out that we share similar interests. Healthy debate allows room for creativity. And so in those formal spaces, because there's discourse and because it can be healthy discourse, it allows room for growth.
The advocacy work that you do for supporting reentry and for greater educational equity are interconnected. And from what you're saying, you know, your education can be taken away from you. That sounds like it really stemmed from a need for self-sufficiency. And I know that you have said that it's very important to you. Tell me more about what self-sufficiency means to you.
Self-sufficiency means that I do not have to rely on a system in order for me to thrive. Self-sufficiency means financial freedom. It means the freedom to think and to be. And so I strive, even though I work for RJI, and even though I created this nonprofit, and my wife and I been working on a business. Although these things are great, my ultimate goal, like for me, self-sufficiency is the freedom to help people, right? Without limitations, without bounds. I don't want to give you a handout. I just want to be that pathway for you to do that yourself, right? And to be that guiding voice. It's more like healing. This work is healing for me. And there's a selfish component to why I also do this work, right? Because, again, like I said, I'm a caregiver. To watch someone thrive, right? Coming out of that pit of darkness, and they're like, oh, wait, I actually can do this. Yeah, you can do it, right? Someone told me the other day, like, dude, I remember you were running a gang, right, back in Brooklyn. Now I see you, and I'm going back to school, like, because I'm watching you, and it's like, you know what, that's dope, right? But I don't feel like I'm a role model. Like, I don't feel like that I'm charting a path, because I feel like when someone knocks at my door and say, how do I get on the path to leave this gang? How do I get on the path to recovery? How do I get on the path? Like, how did you do it? Like, I need to be ready. Like, so I feel like I'm preparing myself for that door to open, for someone to knock on that door, to be like, hey, Divine, I need your help. Okay, what do you need? Or how can I be of assistance? It's a service, right? And there's no greater place to find happiness but within service, right? If you are of service to others, your problems to take care of themselves.
Earlier this summer, our local community joined thousands of others across the country to protest racial injustice and police brutality. And you joined efforts with the 320 Coalition in State College in demanding changes to be made within the police department. What brought you out there to push for those changes?
I had a desire to no longer be silenced. I've sat back year after year after year and watched this state-sanctioned violence against African-American people. And it's like, well, eventually, like, we'll get there. And I stayed within my tunnel vision. I have a goal. I need to get there. That's what I'm going to do. And when I get there, I'll figure out how to help. And watching Ahmaud get murdered, and then turning right around and watching George Floyd get murdered, and the justification behind that, it jarred me, because like you said, I was given these awards this year, right? And I was rewarded for my work, but the narrative and their justification was, these people are criminals. But wait, I actually have a criminal record, right? Just like these men and women that you can pick out of any news story. And we criminalize them, although they were the victims of state-sanctioned violence, right? And so I could no longer be silenced. Wait, if you can kill them on camera and not seek justice, who's to say that if I got pulled over, despite all of the good that the community feels that I'm doing, that you can't kill me also and get away with it. When you look at restorative justice, the meaning of restorative justice, it's typically the offender, the victim, and the community. And you bring them into this setting and you try to figure out how to create a healing space for everyone. What typically does not happen, though, is we don't look at the person who committed the offense as also being harmed, right? There's some form of trauma. There's something that has happened to this individual way before they started harming others. And we don't remedy that. And so how are we restoring anything if only one person or two parts of that component, the victim and the community, are getting any type of retribution and we're not healing the offender? So is it restorative justice? That's what we do at RGI. We look at everybody has been harmed. How do we mitigate that? How do we fix all of this? And this way we can live together.
And you have also shared with me that you plan on going to law school after finishing your undergraduate study at Penn State and maybe run for office one day. What's driving those ambitions?
All three of my degrees will actually be in the three components of my program. Entrepreneurship, I have an associate's degree in business, counseling, rehabilitation and human services. That's a heavy emphasis in counseling. And then legal. That's why I'm heading to law school. So that's what's pushing those efforts. And that's mainly because I got tired of asking people to help me. And the responses were usually very condescending and patronizing. That's a great idea, Divine. Keep going. Pat me on my shoulder and tell me to go about my business. And I couldn't do that anymore until I'm back in school. And I'm going to succeed at doing this. And office, running for office, will help me help people like me. You can't have a society without crime. That's unrealistic. But how we handle individuals who commit crimes can change. And what we do with that time while people are incarcerated can also change. And it's up to us to make sure that it does. If people in office don't see that, our society won't get any better.
Divine Lipscomb, thank you for joining us on Take Note.
Thank you for having me.
Divine Lipscomb is a formerly incarcerated student studying rehabilitation and human services at Penn State. He also works as a special projects coordinator for the Restorative Justice Initiative in the College of Education. He's the recipient of this year's Outstanding Adult Student Award at Penn State and the Stand Up Award from the Rock Ethics Institute. You can listen to more Take Note interviews on wpsu.org/take note. I'm Min Shen, WPSU.